Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It's February the 20th, and we are in a redemption class in Parsha Shmos, and we are on page 298. And we are in the episode, or the episodes, of Moshe, where he came out of the palace and he found an Egyptian viciously beating a Jew, and he killed the Egyptian. And then he came out on the second day and saw one Jew and another Jew fighting, and he said to one of them, "Why are you trying to why do you," he said to the Rasha, "why are you hitting your brother?" So they said, they did not answer nicely about that. We'll go over that verse again. Last week we mentioned that there are many questions over here which we have to address to figure out what is happening over here, who is fighting, who is being beaten, what's happening in this whole episode. The before he kills the Egyptian, it says that he looked both ways to make sure there was no one around. That's what it says in Pasuk. In Pasuk Yud Beis 12, it says, Vayifan Kovacho, he looked this way and that way, Vayar Keinish, and he saw there was no one around. And he struck the Mitzri, and he covered him in sand. He buried him in the sand, not to have the evidence there. We mentioned last week also that the way that Moshe killed him, Moshe didn't have any weapons. Who remembers how he killed him?
The
he used the name of God. He used the Shema Meforesh, name of God, to kill the Egyptian.
How old is Moshe at this time?
Don't know.
No one knows?
I didn't say that. So I don't. Now, let's start again from Pasuk Gimel, verse 13. Vayetze bayom hasheni, he went out on the second day. Vineishne anoshim ivrim nitzim, and behold, two Jewish men were fighting. Vayomer laRasha, he said to the evil one, Lama sakereyecha, why do you strike your friend? Vayomer, he said, the one who was about to strike the other Jew, said to Moshe, Mi samcha liish sar v'shofet aleinu, who made you a dignitary, is that what it says?
Yeah.
Dignitary and a ruler over us. Halo hargeni ata omer, are you saying to kill me? Kasha harakti asamitri, like you killed the Egyptian. Now, this is how we know, as I mentioned last week, this is how we know that Moshe killed the Egyptian using God's name. Because what this person says to Moshe is, are you saying to kill me? Meaning, are you going to speak and kill me the same way you spoke and killed the Egyptian? Vayira Moshe vayomar, Moshe was afraid, and he said, Achein enoda hadavar, the matter, indeed the matter is known. So the matter must be known that he killed the Egyptian, even though it seems there was no one around to witness his killing the Egyptian. Moshe made sure of that. Before he killed the Egyptian, he looked both ways, made sure there was no one around. But now he sees that there was somebody around. Somebody knows about it. Vayishma Paro es hadavar hazeh, Paro heard about this thing. Vayivakesh laharoges Moshe, so he wanted to execute Moshe for having killed an Egyptian taskmaster. Vayivrach Moshe mipnei Paro, Moshe ran away from before Paro. Vayeshev beretz Midyan, and he dwelled in the land of Midyan. Vayeshev ala be'er, and he dwelled on the well. He went to the well, as we mentioned last week, because he was looking for a wife. And all Jewish men know, you find a wife at the well. Now,
this is close to one here.
That's close. Now, the thank you, appreciate that. Thank you. So, we said last week that if no one was there to witness it, how is it that these two Jews know about the incident of Moshe killing the Egyptian? So we said last week that there was someone else there when Moshe killed the Egyptian. And who was the person who was there when Moshe killed the Egyptian?
Jew.
Which Jew?
The one the Egyptian was.
The one who was being beaten, the Jew who was being viciously beaten by the Egyptian, was there. So it therefore seems that that Jew did not keep quiet about it. And now Moshe is afraid that it has become public, and in fact it was. Paro found out about it, and Paro wanted to kill Moshe. So we said last week that now what we need to do is understand who was the Jew who was being beaten, and who are these Jews who are fighting. So to do this, we're going to skip ahead to an episode that happens much later in the Torah. Read that episode, because Chazal, our sages, tell us that the two episodes are related. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech
haolam shehakol nivra. Now the question is, how come Pharaoh would care? I mean, this is Moses, he's like Prince of Egypt. Why would he care if some Stam taskmaster was killed?
So last week we said that it's not a Stam taskmaster, that the whole system in Egypt, which had the social pyramid and the caste system, where the Jews were the very, very bottom of the totem pole, that was untouchable. Anybody who dared to toy with that was risked execution. Because anytime you have a slave nation, you absolutely cannot allow anybody to have any sort of freedom or any inkling of freedom, because that destroys the whole system. There can't be any kind of possible change in the system. And here, by killing a taskmaster, that is a direct affront to the system. That's what we said last week. So we see that did not happen. That's part of what we have to talk about. So if we turn now to page 690, this incident happens after the Jews leave Egypt, which is many years after this episode we just read. More than 40 years later. Exactly how long I don't know, but certainly more than 40 years. So here there is an episode that happens, and this is the episode of the Mekalo, of the one who curses God. So it's the very last word on the Hebrew side on page 690. It's not even at all on the English side. It's in the English, it starts on page 693. Vayetze, it's Pasuk Yud, verse 10. Vayetze ben Isha Yisraelis, and a man who is the son of a Jewish woman went out, Vuhu ben Ish Mitzri, and he was the son of an Egyptian man, Besoch ben Yisrael, he went out amongst the Jewish people. Vayinatsu b'machane, and they had a fight in the camp. Ben Hayisraelis, the son of the Jewish woman, meaning the Jewish woman and Egyptian man, V'ish Hayisraeli, and the Jewish man. So a boy whose mother was Jewish, not a boy, a man, whose mother was Jewish and father was Egyptian, has an altercation with a Jewish man. V'yikov ben Hayisha Hayisraelis is Hashem V'yikalel. And the man who was the son of the Jewish woman and a non-Jewish man, he pronounced the name of God and he cursed it. Vayaviu so al Moshe, they brought him to Moshe. V'shem imo, and the name of his mother was Shlomis bas Divri lamate Dun. Shlomis bas Divri, to the tribe of Dun. Vayani chuhu bamishmar, they kept him under guard. Lifrosh lohem api Hashem, to find out what to do, to ask for themselves from Hashem to find out what to do. And God tells Moshe that the punishment for cursing God is execution, and the form of execution is stoning, and that is what happens. So they execute this man for cursing God. It's one of the two formal executions that take place in the wilderness after we left Egypt. There are more, of course, because there's different wars and there are other things that happen. I mean, just in this past week's parsha, when you have the sin of the golden calf, So Moshe calls the tribe of Levi, and the tribe of Levi goes and kills 3,000 people who worship the golden calf. So there are other types of executions that happen, but this is a very formal one with a court case and everything the way you would expect it to take place.
What do we know why he cursed?
Yeah, that's what we're going to talk about.
Okay.
And also, the measures say like who he's fighting with and what are the.
Yeah, that's what we're going to talk about right now. So, what is this fight about that he's cursing, and what's he upset about? So the Medrash tells us that the issue over here was a place in the land of Israel, even though they weren't in Israel at this time. But the question was, where would this man who had a Jewish mother but a non-Jewish father, where would he put up his tent in the wilderness when they were in the Midbar? Which would then dictate where he would have a portion in the land of Israel, because that's how it worked. The different tribes, they camped together when they were in the wilderness, and when they got to Israel, then they got their portions in the land of Israel together. So this man assumed that he should put his tent up with the tribe of Dan, because his mother was from Dan. But there was a man who protested and said, you can't do that, because the rule is that in this regard you follow your father's lineage. Even though we know that whether a person is Jewish or not is determined by his mother, we believe in matrilineal descent regarding whether a person is Jewish, but within the Jewish people, what tribe we are each from depends on our father, not on our mother. For example, a Levi or a Kohen depends on whether one's father is a Levi or a Kohen, not one's mother. My mother happens to be a Levi. My father is not. So I am not a Levi. It follows the father. It does not follow the mother. And so, this man who wanted to put up his tent in the tribe of Dan, but there was another man who protested and said, you can't do that, because your father is not from Dan. Only your mother is. And therefore, you can't put your tent up with Dan. You would have to put your tent up along with anybody else who does not have a Jewish father, namely converts, and therefore you don't have a portion in the land of Israel, because converts don't get a portion in the land of Israel, and you don't either, because your father is not Jewish. And that was the court case. That was the fight that they had. It went to court, and in court, Moshe ruled that the other man is correct, that the Torah says it follows the father, and therefore this man does not get to have a portion of the land of Israel. He was very upset about that, and he walked out of court, and he cursed God. So his situation went from bad to worse. He did it in front of witnesses. It was an open and shut case, and therefore they had to ask Hashem what to do about it, and Hashem said he needs to be executed for that. It's not a crime to have a non-Jewish father, but it is a crime to curse God. So that's the story. It's a very, very sad story that happens here in the wilderness.
So if he didn't have a portion, where would the converts? They couldn't own property, basically, in Israel, right?
They could buy property, but they couldn't. They weren't automatically given property.
Property, okay.
Right.
And after the Jubilee, it would go back.
That's correct. Now, so the Medrash tells us that an incredible thing took place while the Jews were in Egypt. And it's really an amazing, one of the greatest miracles that took place with our ancestors in Egypt is that the Jewish women were not molested by the Egyptian men. It is almost a given that when there is a slave culture, the slaves have no rights, and the slaves have no autonomy whatsoever, and therefore the women are easily taken advantage of. There's nothing to stop the people that are enslaving the slaves from molesting the women, because there's no law and order. The slaves have no rights. The slaves can never take anybody to court. The slaves can never complain. It doesn't make a difference what the masters do. The slaves have no autonomy. And therefore, it is almost a given that whenever there is a slave nation, a slave people, that they are molested, that they are taken advantage of, and it's virtually impossible to stop that. We know that was true with American slavery, and it's been true throughout history. The Jewish women were not molested by the Egyptians. We know this because when the Jews are counted in Parshas Pinchas, and there it says which that we Jews, who we are, and from which tribes, that there Hashem puts his name on the Jewish people and says that I attest to the fact, I testify that they are the sons of their fathers, that they are not a product of Egyptian molestation. That it was a miracle. Perhaps not an open miracle, but it was certainly a miracle. It was God's protection, it was divine protection of the Jewish people. And this was, why did we deserve such protection? So this goes back to what we mentioned a few weeks ago, that the Jews survived Egypt, and there was a nation to be redeemed because of the righteousness of the Jewish women. Because the Jewish women were willing to, as we mentioned in detail in the past, and they were willing to go through incredible pain and suffering in order to procreate in Egypt, and were willing to endure not only their own physical suffering, but the emotional suffering of what would happen to the children. They're willing to go through that in order to make sure that there was a continuity for the Jewish nation. And as a result, Hashem protected the Jewish women from the Egyptian men. The Medrash tells us there was only one exception. There was only one Jewish woman who was molested, and that was this woman mentioned here on page 692, Shlomis Bas Divri. Shlomis Bas Divri from the tribe of Dan was molested by an Egyptian man, and she became pregnant from that molestation, and this man was born from that, and he's the one who eventually cursed God. How did it happen that she was molested? It was not an open case of molestation. It was actually, she didn't even realize it was happening at the time. The Medrash explains to us that she was a little bit too social. Shlomis Bas Divri literally means, Shlomis means from the word shalom, which means hello, how are you, how's things going? And Divri means dibor, to speak. She was a little bit too social, and she was willing to speak and be social even with the Egyptians. And as a result, one of the Egyptian taskmasters became interested in her. And the Gemara tells us that this is very difficult to understand fully, but the Gemara tells us that an Egyptian, that this taskmaster went in the middle of the night and went into their home, and she took her husband out of the home and sent them out into the field. So he dragged him out into the field and I guess set him to work in the middle of the night. Then that Egyptian taskmaster went into the home and molested his wife. His wife thought that he was her husband. She didn't realize what was happening. Remember, when there was no artificial light, it was pitch black. And so she did not know. Who knows exactly what the situation was, but she did not realize. At any rate, that's what happened. Then the man came back eventually, realized what happened, and the next morning, when he knew what had happened, he evidently said something, or it was clear that he had recognized what had happened. When the taskmaster realized that this Jew knew what had happened, and remember, this was the only Egyptian to have molested a Jewish woman, so this taskmaster began to viciously beat the Jewish man. This is the man whose wife he had molested the night before. That's what is happening here on page 298 that we just read. The episode that Moshe comes out, he comes out and he sees, the first day he comes out, he sees an Egyptian taskmaster viciously beating a Jewish man. Viciously beating him, in other words, he wants to kill him. Because the Jewish man has realized what has happened with his wife, that this taskmaster has molested his wife. Moshe understands this, And Moshe therefore kills the Egyptian, and the Egyptian had it coming to him. So he kills the Egyptian and buries him in the sand. The next day, Moshe comes outside, and there are two Jews fighting. And we asked, how could it be that there are two Jews, excuse me, that's okay, there are two Jews fighting. Moshe says to them, why are you hitting each other? And the other one, one of them says, do you want to kill me the same way that you killed the Egyptian? Now, we just said before, how did he know that Moshe killed the Egyptian? It was done privately. There was no one there except for the Jewish man who was being beaten. Evidently, the Jewish man who was being beaten repeated the story. Or, the Jewish man who was being beaten is the man who said to Moshe, do you want to kill me the same way you killed the Egyptian? Who were the two Jews who were fighting? This we also know from the Gemara. The Gemara tells us, Dasan and Aviram. We are introduced here for the first time to Dasan and Aviram. Dasan and Aviram are going to be thorns in Moshe's side until they themselves are killed in the episode of Korach. It's going to be a little while. They're going to come up several times. Dasan and Aviram. Dasan and Aviram have a streak in them which is not very good. And here we find it for the first time. They are fighting with each other. We are going to find that later on, when the Mun first comes down from the Jewish people, that Dasan and Aviram are going to try to undermine Moshe with the Mun. When Moshe makes certain predictions about the Mun, Dasan and Aviram are going to try to undermine Moshe. We find that they are going to join the rebellion of Korach. They are thorns in Moshe's side. On the other hand, Dasan and Aviram are not all bad. We know they were not all bad because, first of all, they got out of Egypt. Remember that in the plague of darkness, which we haven't gotten to yet, in the plague of darkness, the Jews who were evil and did not want to leave Egypt were killed during the plague of darkness. God killed them. And so Dasan and Aviram, who were not killed during the plague of darkness, clearly were not evil people. There was some righteousness in them as well. Second, it is also clear from later on in Parsha Shmos, which we'll get to hopefully in a number of classes. I don't know exactly when it's going to be, but we'll get to it relatively soon. We are going to find that there were two groups there was a hierarchy over the Jewish slaves. There were the Egyptian taskmasters, and then the Egyptian taskmasters were themselves in charge of the Jewish, what we would call the equivalent of kapos. Same way that in the Holocaust in the camps, that the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, that they put Jews in charge of Jews, the same thing happened in Egypt. And there were shotrim, there were Jews who were to oversee the work, oversee the labor. And they were the ones who were expected to make sure that their brethren completed the work they were supposed to complete. Later on, we are going to find that the Jews who were the shotrim, who were in charge of the work, rather than beat their fellow Jews who were not doing the work properly, if work wasn't getting completed, they themselves got beaten. They were willing to get beaten rather than press their fellow Jews to work more than they could. And later we will find that these shotrim, that these Jewish, let's get a good word for it, that these, the Egyptians are the taskmasters, and the the foreman, that's what they translate over here. So you had Jewish foreman and you had Egyptian taskmasters. The foremen were not willing to put pressure on the Jewish men and women who are working, and therefore when the work did not get done, they themselves got beaten. They will be richly rewarded for that, for being willing to be beaten rather than put pressure on their fellow Jews. They will be rewarded for it. Dasan and Aviram, it seems clear, were two of the foremen, that they themselves were two of the foremen, and they themselves did get beaten rather than hurt their fellow Jews. So Das and Avim are not all bad, but they definitely have something about them which is bad, and they don't correct it, and eventually will lead to their downfall when they join the rebellion of Korach. Here we're introduced to them for the first time. Moshe comes out on the second day, and Dasan and Aviram are having an altercation, and one is ready to hit the other one. Moshe says to him, "Why do you hit your brother?" He says to Moshe, "Do you want to kill me the same way you killed the Egyptian?" Either the one who was being beaten by the Egyptian told Dasan and Aviram about what happened, or it is Dasan himself who was being beaten by the Egyptian.
Why Dasan and Aviram?
One or the other, whichever one it was over here. That one of them was being beaten by the Egyptian. Moshe saved his life by killing the Egyptian. Then on the next day, Dasan and Aviram are having a fight, and Moshe says, "Why do you hit your friend?" And Dasan says to him, "Who died and made you king? You want to kill me the same way you killed the Egyptian?" So there we find immediately the lack of gratitude that they have for Moshe. Moshe says that Moshe was afraid, and he said, "Acheinu daha davar," which is translated as, "Indeed the matter is known." The simple meaning of what Moshe is saying is that indeed the matter is known, that it's gotten around. People know that I killed the Egyptian, and we'll get back to Paro. The Medrash says, the Gemara says, that what Moshe is saying here is, indeed the matter is known. I didn't understand why the Jews would have to be slaves. What did the Jews do wrong? How come we are stuck as slaves? What did we do that's so bad that we should be slaves in this way and have to work so hard? But indeed the matter is known. Because if I see that Jews are willing to act this way, they're willing to fight with each other, and they're willing to threaten me and not have gratitude for what I did, and they are willing to threaten me with Lashon Hara. They themselves went and told Paro about what Moshe did. So Moshe says, now I understand why the Jews are stuck in Egypt. Because if this is the way they're acting, at least some of them are acting this way, then he is concerned that they will not merit being able to leave Egypt. These two told Paro about what Moshe did, and then Paro wanted to execute Moshe. Now, we don't get the full story here, but we do know that Moshe names his second son Eliezer, and we'll see later on he names him Eliezer, which means God saves, God helps, because God saved me from the sword of Paro. So we're not told the story over here of what happened, but we know that when Paro tried to execute Moshe, Hashem saved Moshe from the sword of Paro. And the Medrash fills in the blanks that Moshe was taken before a tribunal, and the ruling was that he would be executed, and he was taken out to be beheaded. And when that was about to happen, the Medrash says that Moshe's neck turned to stone, and the sword was unable to cut Moshe's neck. And then Moshe was able to jump down from the executioner's stand, and he was able to escape. Hashem made a miracle that they were unable to see him, they were unable to catch him, they were unable to yell and grab him, and he was able to get away. And Moshe runs away and runs to the country of Midian, where, as we said, he goes to the well in order to find himself a wife. Now, when Moshe will, he's going to go to Midian. In Midian, he's going to marry, and he's going to have the episode of the burning bush, as we know, and then he's going to go back to Egypt. When he goes back to Egypt, he's going to be 80 years old. How much time is he in Midian, and how much time elapses from the time that he runs away from Egypt before he gets to Midian is not clear. Does not tell us anywhere how much time elapses over here.
I thought I heard the rabbi, Bostonian rabbi, Yeah. In his speech.
He was 17.
17. When did he say he was 17?
When he ran away, he was 17.
Could be.
Could be, yeah.
Could be.
Yeah.
It doesn't say it in the Nipsukim. Maybe there is a medrash like that that I'm not familiar with. It's possible. So there is much that happens in Moshe's life, but we are not told in the Torah what it is. And that's just a gap that we have in Moshe's life.
But at 80 years old, he finds the burning bush?
At 80 years old is when the episode of the burning bush happens. Well, that will be explicit in the Torah itself. It'll tell us how old he was when he comes back to Egypt. But from the time he runs away until he meets his wife, we don't know how much time that was, and then how long he's in Midian, and eventually comes back to Egypt. So Moshe here has to escape from Egypt. And that's it. That is all we're going to know about Egypt. Once Moshe runs away from Egypt, we don't find out anything about Egypt until it's time for Moshe to come back to Egypt. And many years pass, it's years of slavery. Very difficult, hard years for the Jewish people are going to pass before Moshe returns to Egypt. But the story of the Torah shifts away from Egypt to Moshe. Once Moshe is born, which happened in the beginning of the second chapter of Shmos, once Moshe is born, the spotlight of the Torah, if you will, is on Moshe. It's wherever Moshe is. Moshe is usually with the Jewish people. But the thread of the story follows Moshe. Moshe is in Egypt. Moshe is in the palace of Paro. Moshe comes out and sees what's happening with these two episodes. The Egyptian viciously beating the Jew. The two Jews fighting. Moshe runs away to Midian. The camera moves to Midian. The Jewish people are there in Egypt in terrible slavery, but the camera is in Midian, because that's where Moshe is. We follow Moshe. The burning bush, all the episodes of Moshe. Moshe comes back to Egypt. The camera moves back to Egypt. From that point on, Moshe, of course, is not separated from the Jewish people. He remains with the Jews in Egypt, and then when we leave Egypt, and Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, and onward into the wilderness, etc., that the camera follows Moshe. There are very few exceptions to this throughout the Torah. In fact, this last week's parasha is one of the very few exceptions. When Moshe is up on the mountain, and the Jews commit the sin of the golden calf, the camera for a short time shifts away from Moshe to the people and their worshipping of the golden calf. They're creating and worshipping the golden calf. And then it immediately goes back to Moshe. That's a very, very unusual event in the Torah where the camera moves away from Moshe. But we follow Moshe once he's born throughout his, wherever he goes, that's where the Torah goes. Yes?
I was wondering if there was some connection between the incident of Amimelech and God threatening to kill him if he touched Abraham's wife, and the fact that the Egyptians were afraid to assault the Jewish women.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that. That's a nice point. I wouldn't say that incident. I would say instead of the incident with Paro and Sarah. Because that was an incident where she was with Paro, and Paro was not unable to touch her. And that could be. It could be Maisa Avos Sim Labanim. It could be that what happened to the patriarchs is what happens to their children. Yes. It's okay when you think of it. You can chime right in. Yeah.
No.
No. Okay. Okay. So Moshe goes to
You know, our forefathers went to Laban's family. And, you know, why didn't Moshe go to? Why did he marry Zipporah?
Okay. So why did he run to Midian?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, first of all, we're dealing with proximity. Midian is located somewhere south of Israel. Exactly where, I don't know. But it is somewhere south of Israel. It is relatively close to Egypt. Lavan lived way up northeast of Israel. Way up in present-day Iraq. And that would have been quite a trip for Moshe to get all the way up there. So I imagine that it has to do with proximity. Well, he's got to find a wife. Where? I mean, he can find a wife anywhere.
Yeah.
As long as she's righteous, he can find a wife anywhere. Anywhere he looks.
Yeah, but she was, not affiliated with any of our heritage.
That's true. That's a good point. Moshe is not a patriarch. You're right. You're bringing up the point that we showed that our patriarchs, Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, all married within the family. They all married within the family of Abraham, his brother's descendants. That's who they married. And here we find that Moshe does not follow that path. But Moshe is not a patriarch. He's not starting a nation. Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were starting a nation. And that apparently had to come from within Abraham's family. But that's a very good point. So he goes to Midian and he goes to the well. And now the Torah tells us in Pasuk Tezayin, verse 16, Ulukohain Midian Sheva Banos. And the Kohen of Midian had seven daughters. Now, the way that they translate it is the minister of Midian. Exactly what his position was, this is Yisro, exactly what his position was is not clear. It just says Kohen. Kohen usually means some sort of a priest. Whether it means a priest or just means that he was a respected or highly thought of member of the community, either way, he's called a Kohen. Kohen Midian, he had seven daughters. Vatavona vatidlena, they came and they drew water. Vatimalena eshara hatim, and they filled the troughs. Lahashkos son avihen, to water the flock of their father. Now this is clear then that Yisro did not have any sons. Anybody who had sons would not send his daughters to tend the flock. First of all, it was a man's job in those days, number one, and number two, it was dangerous because there were men who, you're out in the middle of nowhere and you're dealing with it and dealing with the flock and watering the flock, and there are men around and who knows what can happen to the daughters.
What did that
rock? What's that? The same thing happened over there. He had no sons either. That's how we know he didn't have any sons at that point. Because Rachel, well, later on Laban has sons, but that's only after Yaakov comes.
Something is right dear to me. It says, Moses settled in Midian, and he got a wife.
Well, not yet. We haven't read it. He got a wife yet, but yeah, about to get a wife.
Yeah. Then he says he's married, and then it says Moses sought a wife. So, how many wives is he looking for at the beginning?
Only one.
That's
only, he only marries one. But we haven't gotten to it yet. He's looking for a wife. So the seven daughters of the Kohen of Midian come and they fill the troughs for the flock of their father. Vayavohu horoim, and the shepherds came, vayagarashum, and they chased them away. Vayakam Moshe vayoshion, Moshe got up and he saved them. Vayashk es tzonam, and he watered their flock. Now why did the shepherds chase away the daughters of Yisro? So it is well known, if you find this in several places, that Yisro was a man who was very who did not leave anything up to what he heard from other people. He wanted to experience everything for himself and know for himself what the truth was. He was very interested to know what is the true, real religion, who is the real God. And therefore, the Gemara tells us that Yisro did not ignore any religion. He tried out every single religion that there was on the face of the earth at that time. Every sort of paganism, everything. He worshipped and tried everything. And eventually he arrived at the conclusion that idolatry, paganism, is false and foolish, and he gave it up. He was very intellectually honest, and after going through the whole thing, he arrived at the conclusion of essentially of monotheism and rejected all of the idolatry of the people around him. That's a very difficult thing to do. When everybody else is doing one thing, to on one's own, because of one's own investigation, to arrive at a conclusion that they're all wrong and reject it, that's a very difficult thing to do. And in this regard, Yisro is similar to Avraham Avinu. Mm-hmm. Avraham, who himself rejected everything around him, Yisro is not quite as as amazing as Avraham Avinu, because there were in Yisro's time there were Jews, so there were other people who had rejected paganism. Of course, they were slaves in Egypt; they weren't riding high at the time. But nevertheless, there was a precedent. Still, and with Avraham, there were no precedent. There was no precedent. But nevertheless, what Yisro did is an amazing thing. Incredible strength of character. When he did that, he became ostracized. The people around him said that this man is crazy, this man has given up worshipping properly, it is an affront to all of our idols, and they ostracized him. And so when the daughters of Yisro came to fill the troughs, they were chased away by the shepherds. Moshe saw this, got up, and saved them, and he watered the flock. Then an amazing thing happens. Pasuk Yeches, verse 18. Vatavona el Ru'el avihen. They came to Ru'el, their father. Now Yisro's name has not been mentioned yet. It just said the Kohen of Midian. His name was not given. Now we're given a name, Ru'el. We know that Yisro has seven names, and Ru'el is one of them. So they come to Ru'el, their father. Vayomer, and he says, Madua miharten bo hayom. Why have you come home so quickly today? You've come home unusually quickly. Vatomarna, and they said, Ish mitzri hitzilanu miyad haroim. An Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds. Vagam dolo dolo lanu. He also drew water for us. Vayashke satzon. And he watered the flock. Now, the observation we're going to make right now often escapes people reading these few verses. And let's understand this very clearly. Yisro is saying to his daughters that let's repeat it. The daughters go and they draw water from the well, and they pour the water into the troughs in order to water the flock. Then the shepherds come. They say, "Hey, what are you guys doing here?" And they come chasing after them. The girls have to run away.
Well, why didn't that happen before?
Wait a minute. The girls have to run away. Moshe sees this. He gets up and he saves them. So he either, I don't know what he does to the Egyptian to the shepherds. He either fights with them or whatever it is. He saves the girls. The girls come back, and Moshe draws more water and waters the flock. Then the girls say, "Thank you so much," and they leave, and they come home with the flock. And Yisro says, "How'd you get home so fast?" So they say, "Well, you know what happened? There was an Egyptian man who saved us from the shepherds." Now, what do you mean, why did you come home so fast? What happened on a normal day?
Yeah.
On a regular day, what would happen? Is this the first time that the shepherds chased away the girls?
They never told him. They may have never told him that they were chasing them.
But now they're coming home and they're saying, an Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds. It sounds like...
this could be the first time they're telling him that the shepherds were mistreating them.
Well, then they would have to explain that. They just said, "Saved us from the shepherds." It sounds like the shepherds is a known thing.
Right.
From the way they're describing it, and from the fact that Yisro was surprised they came home so quickly, it sounds like this was common practice. This was a daily occurrence. The girls would go out, and they would draw the water, and the shepherds would come and say, "What are you guys doing here?" and chase them off. And it would be a whole to-do in order for them to finally get the water. And then eventually they'd come home very late. And today, Moshe was there, and Moshe stopped this from happening. That means that this is going on a regular basis. Yes?
I was just going to say that maybe they came home early because on a regular day when the shepherds chased them away, the shepherds simply took advantage of the fact that they'd already filled the troughs, watered their own flocks, and then the girls would have to come back and schlep all this water out of the well and refill the troughs. And that's what
I imagine you're right. I imagine something like that happened. And so it's just an amazing thing that this was just a daily occurrence. It was a way of life. It was a way of life. They had no other way of dealing with it. They were ostracized. There was no one who would stand up for them. It was Yisro. He may have been married. He may have had a wife who was still alive. And seven daughters. And that was it. That was all they had. There was no one else. There was no police force that was going to step in for them. There was no one who would stand up for these girls. And they would go and draw the water and try to water the flock. Got to water the flock or the flock's going to die. And so this would happen on a daily basis. And the shepherds would come and chase them away and, like, possibly, like you said, and use the water. And somehow or other, they finally were able to get the water and water the flock. So when Moshe stepped in and saved them, they got home early. And Yisro said, "What is this? How'd you get home early?" He said, "Well, you're never going to believe what happened today. There was an Egyptian man, and he saved us from the shepherds. And not only that, he also drew more water for us, and he watered the flock." It totally, out of the blue, completely unexpected thing to happen. Which is why Yisro reacts and says, in an exasperated way, in the next pasuk, the next verse, pasuk chav, verse 20, Vayomer el ben Osav, and he said to his daughters, this is my favorite word in the whole Torah. He says to his daughters, Ve'ayo, and where is he? I can just picture it, the man with his seven daughters coming home. He says, and where is he? It's said in such a sarcastic way. Obviously, it's not done meant to be sarcastic, but it's the way we would say it. Where is he? Lama ze'azavtenes ha'ish. Why did you leave the man? Kiren lo, call him, fiyochal lochem, and he will eat bread. What did you leave him at the well for? Here he saved you, and you just left him there? Like, what are you thinking? Here you have a man who stepped out of nowhere to save them. They had no help from anybody for the past whatever amount of time. And this has been going on for some time, that it became a way of life. And now a man steps in and saves you, and you just leave him at the well? Call him and let him eat bread. And as the Gemara explains to us, let him eat bread is a way of saying he will possibly marry one of you. Let him come to the house and he'll meet you, and then perhaps he'll marry one of you. And that's in fact what happens, as the next pasuk says, Chafal 21, Vayoel Moshe lo shevez es ha'ish. Moshe desired, okay, or agreed to dwell with the man. Vayitenes tziporah vitol Moshe, and he gave Tzipora, his daughter, to Moshe. And that is a result of Moshe having stood up for them. They came back and brought back Moshe to the house, and then he marries Tzipora. Yes?
So it sounds to me that like the daughters also, you know, if it's just because the father decides to not go along spiritually with the practices of the era, that doesn't mean the daughters wouldn't follow. But it sounds like...
It was assumed that the daughters would follow. I mean, that was, you know...
And whose family?
I mean, certainly in those days, it would be in the common practice. But evidently, they supported their father, you know.
That's the reason, probably, why she married it to marry him.
Yes. Well, she's a righteous woman, as we're going to see. We'll see an episode that will show how righteous she is. But she's a righteous woman, Tzipora.
And what about her sisters?
We don't know much about her sisters. Yes. You go ahead.
I just wanted to know, was not Moshe put in jail? Was this like before or after? When Zipporah was given to him?
It's
put in jail after?
I'm not familiar with the story of Moshe being put in jail.
It's from the Basner Rebbe also.
There are midrashim about it, but I'm not familiar with it.
Maybe she's referring to the fact that Yisro kept Moshe in a pit for years. Mm-hmm.
Another pit?
Is that what happened?
Where did they come from?
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Where does what come from?
I thought it was well
known. The pits, the jail.
Okay. Moshe, is there such a thing?
There were the one of the reasons being to save him from Paro finding him.
Yeah, what about the sword and stone?
Oh, is that what happened?
I'm not familiar with these midrashim. I can look around and see what we find, but I'm not familiar with these offhand. Yes.
But isn't Moses criticized for saying that he's Egyptian? Whereas
There are those who suggest he didn't say he was Egyptian, but there are those who suggest that Moshe is criticized because they called him an Egyptian man.
And he didn't.
That none that he didn't say anything. They didn't call him to his face. The fact that they reported that it was an Egyptian man who saved us means that he projected himself as an Egyptian man.
That's what I wondered, whether his dress or how would they have known?
It must be the way he looked. How else would they say he was an Egyptian man?
Or it could be that Egyptian was the common language of the region.
Yeah, but then
he may have addressed them in Egyptian.
Then he wouldn't be criticized for it. If he's criticized, it means that he was expected to have done differently.
Or also maybe they didn't know how Hebrew looked like.
Well, then again, he wouldn't be criticized for it. If there are those who suggest that Moshe is being criticized here for the fact that they called him an Egyptian man. So if he's criticized, it means that he should have done something differently.
Maybe he's not like Egyptian bush on him.
Could be. Yeah.
I hate to go back again, but isn't Rebecca also a shepherdess and doesn't
and she does have a brother?
What's that?
Rebecca.
Yeah. What about her?
Isn't she a shepherdess?
No.
She gave water.
She was not a shepherdess. She came to draw water from a well.
That was all.
Yeah, she was not a shepherdess. She did water the camels of Eliezer.
That's what.
But she was not a shepherdess. Right. No, because she did have a brother. That she didn't do. So now we have Moshe with Yisro, and we'll read one more pasuk, one more verse. Chaf Beis 22. So he marries Tzipora, Vateled Bain, she gave birth to a son, Vayikra es Shemo Gershom, and he, Moshe, called the name of his son Gershom, Ki Amar, for he said, Ger Hayisi Be'eretz Nachriya, I have been a stranger in a foreign land. So he named his son Gershom for the fact that he was alone in this foreign land, away from his people, away from the Jewish people, all by himself. That's what he names Gershom. There was a when it says in Pasuk Chafal, verse 21, Vayo el Moshe la Sheves es Ha'ish, and Moshe desired, is the way they translated, or you could say he agreed to dwell with the man, with Yisro. The word Vayoel can also mean, and he took an oath. The word Vayoel also means to take an oath, and he took an oath to dwell with Yisro. What oath did he take? So there are two things that Moshe agreed to Yisro about. One is that he agreed that he would not leave Midian without Yisro's permission. And that's why later at the burning bush we're going to find that Moshe goes back and asks permission from Yisro before going back to Egypt. The other deal that Yisro struck with Moshe is Yisro did not want his grandson to simply have one religion. He wanted his grandson to go through a similar process that he went through to try out all the religions and arrive at a conclusion. And so Moshe and Yisro only allowed Moshe to marry Tzipora with the proviso that the grandson would be allowed to do this, to try out the different religions. Now we have to talk further about this. Obviously one is not allowed to do that today. This was before the Torah was given, so that will play into this a little bit. But one is not allowed to do that. One is not allowed to allow any of their children, deliberately allow any of their children, to try out other religions. One is obligated to raise their children in a way that their children will follow the Torah. If the child unfortunately decides to do differently, that can happen. But we as parents are obligated to raise the children in a way that they will follow the Torah. This was a very strange agreement between Moshe and Yisro, and that's something which we're going to have to talk about further. But it does mean that later on we are going to find that when the tribe of Dan gets involved with Pesel Micha, with the idol called Micha, later in the book of Judges in Shoftim, we are going to find a descendant of Moshe playing a prominent role in that sorry episode in our history. And that is a result of this agreement with Yisro. So that's something which we're going to have to follow. It doesn't show itself immediately. In fact, it doesn't show itself at all in the Chumash. But it is something which we'll have to discuss at a later date.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.